welcome once again to the Ashley Webster Experience alongside Brian Solomon, our trusty producer. Hello to you, Brian. And we have a special guest today, Mark Stein. He's a Canadian author, a political commentator, all around good guy. But of course, I want to focus on being Canadian. What's that like?
We are the privileged people of the Western world. Mordecai Richler used to say Canadians can they're what everybody thinks the international Jewish conspiracy is. Canadians can go everywhere. They can pass across borders and seamlessly fit in, and people barely notice them. Like in the United States, in the UK, in France, wherever they are. And if you notice. Some guy wrote a column about that, I think in the Boston Globe, about 3 weeks after 9/11, when they were talking about all these people agitating for a big new war on terror. And he said, what do they have in common? Charles Krauthammer, David Frum, Mark Stein. They're all Canadian. No wars for Canadians.
No. Mm. I've always mistrusted them. I always felt that they were supposed to be our friends. Mm. And we always are focused on the southern border, of course, Mark. Yeah. But, you know,
there will actually be a wall on the northern border long before this one. Because you know
that. But will Canada pay for it?
Yeah.
Northern border.
but there will be one on the 49th parallel long before there's one on the Rio Grande. You can bet on that.
All right, we're going to come back to the Canada thing because it's always a great source of humor and enjoyment. But you've made a name for yourself. I was looking at your bio, Mark, and you started really as an arts critic. Is that right?
I started as a disc jockey, and people don't really have disc jockeys now because they just say, here's another 23 in a row on Smooth and Easy 97.1, and then you go away for 40 minutes. But in those days, I was, for example, I think one of my first jobs, I was pitching for a sort of easy listening kind of show. And I went in and I'd misunderstood the ad. And the guy actually was looking for a guy who did a classical show. I didn't really know anything about classical music.
No.
But I said, oh, yeah, sure, figuring I could bone up on it in the next 10 days and I'd be fine. And actually, that taught me a good lesson, which is that, as you know, you can bluff your way through almost anything in life.
You can.
And expertise can be very lightly worn once you learn to pull that trick off. But the thing I...
All we ever need in life is a lab coat and a clipboard.
That's
what
right.
I've been told. People will believe me regardless.
It's very true. And I found that... So I did a lot of different formats. And then, as is the way of things, I got fired and had no money. And if you've been fired and you've got no money and you've got no skills, then writing and journalism and media work is about the only thing you can do. And again, I'm not telling you anything you don't know.
Anything we got here in my life.
And so I started writing, and I did write mainly on the arts, music, theatre, film for a while. I was always political, and my political views haven't changed. And then I just, I started drifting into political commentary, but left to my own. If we lived in a peaceful, happy world, I'd just be pottering down the musical end and enjoying myself. But one thing those things are connected. In the sense that if you look at what ISIS, that thing a couple of years ago when ISIS seized some musicians, I think it was in northern Libya, and they burned all their cellos and violins on the beach. Or if you look at the Taliban, where they actually made it illegal to listen to music. Mm. They banned music in Afghanistan. If you look at pictures of Kabul in the 60s, there's all these girls in miniskirts in the record shop.
Buying Beatles records?
Yeah, buying Beatles records. They're looking, they look like they could be in Carnaby Street, but instead they're on Allahu Akbar Street in Kabul, and they're listening to these the latest swinging singles. I always think of that because what it's telling you is that Politics isn't just the geopolitical picture. It eventually reaches down and wrecks all the small pleasures in life, too. Mm. So even if you just want to sit around and listen to music all day, unless you're paying attention to the big things, the Taliban will come swaggering into town and wreck it for you.
You're also a singer. Sorry, Brian, I just want to mention, we're talking about music, just to continue on this theme. You're a singer. You have a CD out. I've seen a video.
Right.
Now, videos, of course, were very big back in the 1980s, but this was a classic. Wasn't it like a fog machine and the whole thing?
Yeah, I actually made a – I decided to do – I made an album of cat songs, and if you make an album of cat songs, there's certain ones people expect you to have on there. Like I tore a Putty Tat, which was the big Looney Tunes song that Tweety and Sylvester were running around to for decades. And I didn't want to do it in that Mel Blanc, I tore a Putty Tat. And I couldn't think
would've of – would have been funny.
And I couldn't – well, I didn't think so because he does Mel Blanc better than any – and I couldn't think of any way to do it. And I was driving around and I happened to just be retuning stations and I hit some oldies station and I heard Sting and the Police doing Every Breath You Take. Yeah. And I listened to the – whatever it is, the bass line at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And I thought – wait a minute, I taught a putty tat, doom, doom, doom. And so I did, I basically did I tore a putty tat in the style of Sting and the Police, which you can, when you actually phone your arranger say, hey, listen, I've got it. Okay.
And they hang up.
And they hang up and think when he's come out of his drug bender and he's woken up trouserless in the dumpster, he'll have so it up and he'll tell me something. But we actually did it in the style of Sting and Every Breath You Take. And so I thought I'd make a 1980s rock video to go with
it. Classic.
So that's kind of about as hip as I get, is that I make a 1980s rock video.
Were you
35
in a
years
in that or something?
Yeah, I wore a trench coat. Yeah.
That's right.
You'd be surprised.
London was it fog. In a warehouse or what was it in an alley? What
was it? It was like in an abandoned scuzzy block. And
you must have had a lot of fun doing that.
No, I did have a lot. And funnily enough, I mean, I make no claim for my, that cat album did very well. At one point, he was out selling the "I'm All About That Bass" lady.
Yeah.
At one point,
I'm all about the cats, baby.
A friend of mine who's a 12-time Grammy winner, and I won't embarrass her by naming her, but she had a new album out, and she just like went to Amazon to see how it was doing, and she was like amazed that it was like seven places behind My Lousy Cat. And she goes, "That thing keeps on selling." Well, and you know what? I feel bad. You know, as I said, she's a 12-time Grammy winner.
You're apologizing.
And there's actually, you know, the way it is at the Grammys now, because they've got Grammys for everything. There's best liner notes for a for a gangster rap album for a gangster rapper who hasn't yet been shot on the West Coast. And there's actually no category for me.
There's no animal pets.
And so because even Hillary, Bill Clinton. Both Clinton, this is how ridiculous it is. Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton got a Grammy for It Takes a Village to Raise a Child.
She got a Grammy for that?
Yeah, that's like a Grammy for most uneasy listening or something. and Bill Clinton got a Grammy because he was the narrator on Peter and the Wolf by Prokofiev, which is ludicrous.
Of course, because he played the wolf.
Exactly.
That's typecasting.
All right. So now you live in New Hampshire, right?
That's right, yeah.
I get this vision, Mark, sometimes when I heard that you live in New Hampshire. It's kind of like Ted Kaczynski was holed up in some cabin in the middle of Montana. You're doing the same thing. You're kind of held up in this little wood cabin in the middle of nowhere in New Hampshire. And instead of railing against technology and computers, you're railing about the progressives and the left and the nuttiness that they put out. Is that accurate? You're kind of out there in the woods thinking things through?
Yeah, I am really. And I do. My beard gets sort of Unabomber-like. And then when I come to New York and appear with you on Fox Business. I get it like trimmed so I look more like the assistant choreographer on like Cage aux Folles or whatever. Yeah, and I like to keep it in. It's a question of keeping it in balance. But I think that's when I started writing about America, for example, for British, Canadian, Australian newspapers. Most of those foreign correspondents are in New York, Los Angeles, or Washington. And I think to be somewhere that's not one of those three cities gives you a perspective on things that a lot of those people just in the big Washington bureaus don't see.
They're in a bubble.
Yeah. And I mean, it seemed to me perfectly obvious that Trump, in fact, I think I said Trump was going to win in September 2015 on Alan Combs's radio show. I didn't say that because I particularly thought he was brilliant or whatever, but it seemed to me that he had identified something in rural American life that other people had not seen, and that's obvious if you just where I happen to live. If you drive 50 miles in any direction, you can see what he's talking about, and I think that's useful. Being in that sense, being in the woods, being covered in plaid, letting your assistant choreographer beard grow out. I mean, that is all actually quite useful for seeing what's going on.
Do you know, you use humor to great effect because many a true word is said, you know, with wit. Do you find you have to change your style of humor to the American audience, to the UK audience, to the Australians, to the Canadians, or is it all pretty much the same?
It's different in the variants. I covered the impeachment trial of Monica Lewinsky for President Clinton's impeachment, and my editors in Toronto, London, elsewhere went behind my back because I wanted to be put up at the Mayflower, which was actually a brilliant move, because Monica actually checked into the Mayflower when she testified. I was the only reporter on the inside. But, of course, they wanted to screw me over and have me staying in the Econo Lodge around the back of the freight yards. I found out just as I checked into the Mayflower that they were going to screw me over for the deal. So on the first day of the impeachment trial, I put all my Canadian jokes in the London column, all my Australian jokes in the Toronto column, and all my UK jokes. I think you reach a certain point where. I mean, I like to be. I don't really have a philosophical view on it, but I like to be funny about the big things. And what I always disliked about American newspapers, for example, is you'd have like if you opened up a typical op-ed page, they'd have three columns, you know, the foreign policy guy, the one talking about the new report from the Fed, and one dealing with inner-city crime. And then there'd be a guy in the bottom right-hand corner being funny about barcode scanners at supermarkets.
Right.
And I always thought the great thing is to be funny about the big things, the important things. If you can't be, you know, so I like to be funny, basically, about the collapse of our civilization, because
might as well go down laughing.
Yeah, and whoever's left to prowl around in the rubble, whether it's the jihad guys or the aliens from Planet Zongo, they're going to be laughing their heads off at the way we did this to ourselves. So I think that's actually quite important.
Yeah.
Audience is more receptive? Is the American audience more receptive to your humor? Because we had Steve Hilton on the show, and I asked him, I said, you know, which press is harsher? You know, the British press or the American press? And he said, oh, the British is, you know, off the charts. Yeah. But, you know, you're part of the press that makes light of this. And so who do you think is more receptive to your comedy?
Well, no, I would...
Or to your humor.
I think that's right. That in the UK and in Australia, there's a sort of open viciousness that people like. I'm always interested in what's like what's specific to audiences. My manager's American, and she accompanied me once. First time she accompanied me north of the border was to an event in Ottawa. And I was speaking in Ottawa, and a new governor general had just been appointed, mm-hmm. and Ashley will know what that yes. is. It's like viceregal eminence. You won't know what it is. No. And I'm not going to try Big the title. Patience of your listeners by explaining it. But, like, so I stand up and I do, like, 15 minutes of gags about the Marquess of Dufferin, who was, like governor general in the late 19th century. And my American managers, it's a sea of laughing faces, except for my American manager who's sitting there thinking, what the hell is this? And she's asking me about this afterwards. I go, the Marquess of Dufferin, it's comedy gold. We'd be killing it in Cleveland if I used this stuff. And I always think there's like a particular there's a particular pleasure when and audiences like it. Yeah. Again, because it's like they know it's something that's just for them, mm-hmm, that right. you've that and that's different from, you know, and particularly if you know this, that yeah. if you're Canadian or if you're Australian or whatever, and the big stars are always from elsewhere, so when they yes. come they come jetting in, you know, they're just doesn't matter whether it's
yes
Tom,
to talk about climate change,
yeah yeah
the irony
yeah
because they
yeah.
jet everywhere,
yeah that's right, yeah. and they're talking about it on their terms, and yes. people just always like it if there's a moment that's just for them, but
yeah, to
so
make it personal,
yeah yeah, and that's it.
So how does a Canadian living in New Hampshire have a British accent? I've got to ask that question.
Well, I spent part of my childhood in England, and I was at J.R.R. Tolkien's or old school.
Oh, yes.
So
cool is that?
Yeah, it is quite cool, actually. I wrote him a letter when I was a very small boy, and I was thrilled to get a reply.
Got a reply. Really? Yes. What do you say?
I was just asking him about a particular, I think it was to do with the Silmarillion, which was the incompleted, yes. the uncomplete thing after. Yeah. But I remember reading The Hobbit. I think it was at the age of 7 or something. Mm-hmm. And so I was always, and of course now people don't. After the movie was made, yeah. people think absolutely. Like J.R.R. Tolkien. He was like this New Zealander. And
yeah.
Like,
yeah. The script writer from New
yeah,
Zealand.
Yeah. He's like, the Kiwis are like cleaning up. They're like running these. Oh, is this where J.R.R. Tolkien had his first screenwriting office? Yeah. And
it's funny, but it's true, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this age of Donald Trump, you predicted that he'd win, but for those that make their living, well, looking satirically at things, it's an absolute goldmine. From late night, you know, comedians to yourself, there's so much material all the time.
Well, I'm actually not sure about that, because I think nobody is funnier than Donald Trump himself.
Yes, he's.
And I think that's actually what drives the left nuts. I mean, you look at these late night comedy shows, they've got like 300 gag writers, and they're trying to get a joke on Donald Trump. Mm. And Donald Trump's actually out there every day doing all the best jokes.
Beating them to the punch.
Himself. Yeah. And that was something. I think it was about 2 weeks before the New Hampshire primary. I went to see Donald Trump on stage in the heart of Bernie Sanders' fiefdom in Burlington, Vermont. Because my kids wanted to see him. My daughter had gone and seen him in New Hampshire, and she'd had a real laugh. And so there's not a lot of real laughs to see on stage in Vermont, yeah. New Hampshire. So the boys wanted to go. So we go along, and there's all their schoolmates on Main Street in Burlington. It's cleaved in two. There's anti-Trump protesters, pro-Trump protesters, mm-hmm. has this great party town atmosphere. My kids are running into school friends who are denouncing Trump, pro-Trump. It's fantastic. And this guy, as we're making our way toward the door, this guy says, do you want to come and see the Trumprov night, which is improv comedy about Trump? And so he's handing out free tickets, and we take them to be polite. And I say to the boys, we're not going to go to that.
Right.
Because you know what it's going to be, lame hair jokes, and that's, mm-hmm. we go in, Trump comes. Well, we went backstage to say hello mm-hmm. to him, and he's like the most lightly entouraged political candidate I've ever seen. I've seen guys running for state rep
have a bigger posse.
Who have, and he's just got like Corey Lewandowski, Hope Hicks. That's it.
Yeah.
And he's not normally when you go, you're there just beforehand. People say, oh, we're getting a statement from Kim Jong-un on his latest. We prepared a position for you. And we've run it past the photo. Yeah. And they're like all. Trump's just like there having a laugh. He comes out on stage then and he just starts riffing on the day's news. And he's talking about Martin O'Malley. Yeah. Remember, he was the guy running against Hillary.
Yeah. Right.
And he goes, and he just starts talking about how he'd seen this Martin O'Malley thing where only one, he goes, this is a fabulous crowd. Yeah. I just saw this Martin O'Malley here at a rally. Only one guy showed up. And he's in New Hampshire, and he's sitting there, and Martin O'Malley's like talking to him about what's his position is. Just to the one guy for like an hour and a quarter. And at the end of it, the reporter from Channel 9 says, so are you considering voting for Mr. O'Malley now? And the guy says, no, not really. And that's like, we're all falling around, weeping with laughter. Karl Rove, I'd heard Karl Rove the day before, and he'd, on Fox, he'd been sent. Well, you know, the important thing at this stage, we're a week from Iowa, 2 weeks from New Hampshire. What's critical now is time management. If you're not staying ruthlessly on message, you're just wasting your time. And that just diminishes the time you have to get your real message out. So it's all about a week before Iowa, 2 weeks before New Hampshire. It's all about message discipline and using it. And nowhere in that model of campaigning does it say, do 20 minutes of shtick on Martin O'Malley.
Stand-up comedy.
And Trump did us all a huge service in just blowing through. I mean, I like Karl Rove. I respect Karl Rove. Mm-hmm. But there's something beautiful just to see some guy come in and demolish
all that. He is always, you know, untethered, unplugged. Yeah. And that analogy, I think, Mark, applies to everything he does. Mm. He's off the cuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
He speaks from the heart. He's honest.
Right.
Gets him in trouble sometimes. Mm. I understand that. But, you know, things happen. All of a sudden, we have North Korea saying, well, maybe we do want to talk.
Right.
You know, and the people who have been laughing at Donald Trump, they're going to have to stop at some point because he's getting stuff done.
I think that's true. You know, I only know why I think my neighbors supported him. Mm. I don't make any great claims for universal expertise. But I think the problem is that the kind of house-trained way of doing things has been terrible for large numbers of people in this country. Mm. And one of the things I find odd, I mean, there's two statistics I find really odd, and that's the shrinking social mobility in America.
Yeah.
Because if you have to actually say what the American dream is, that's what it is. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're the whole point about America is that if you were a peasant in 12th century Poland, your great 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 grandkids were going to be a peasant in 14th century Poland, their great 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 grandkids were going to be a peasant in 17th century Poland, and one day one of them gets on a boat to Ellis Island, and he lives in a tenement on the Lower East Side, and his kid moves uptown, and his grandkid becomes a doctor in Westchester County, and his great-grandkid goes to Harvard, and then the great-great-grandkid becomes an environmental activist who wants to shut down economic opportunity for everyone, and the cycle begins over again.
Yes.
But basically, if you don't actually have social mobility, you don't have an American dream.
Yeah. Right.
And I think that's I think that's a problem. And then I think what you also see in large swathes of rural America is downward mobility, where people whose grandparents worked on farms and whose parents worked in mills And now they've got a daughter who does a minimum wage job at the Quickie Crack, and the son is, you know, on meth or heroin or whatever. The downward mobility is like really, and I think that's, you can't keep telling, though, you can't keep telling those people that you, whether it's the left or right, that everything matters about them. You know, really, that should be a Democrat thing. They should be But whenever they listen to Democrats, Democrats are talking about, you know, transgendered bathrooms or something. You know, in other words, something that, you know, they're talking about boutique niche demographics that are barely discernible. And in the meantime, there's millions and millions of people who have ruined lives.
I find go ahead, Brian.
No, isn't that especially the point that President Trump made with the African Americans in this country, saying, you know, that's supposed to be the Democrats helping you guys out, saying, hey, we're going to come into the inner cities and help out.
Right.
And instead, they're focusing on transgender bathrooms. That's exactly the point he was making. And now you see the lowest unemployment rate in history for African Americans.
Yeah. No. I think that's true. I think there's a lot of almost all kind of liberal do-gooding is about the do-gooder rather than the people they're doing it to.
Yeah.
And it's great to be the do-gooder. And if you're on the receiving end, you're getting seriously done, and there's not a lot of good in it. And
that's very true. Well, I think what fascinates me too, Mark, is that the Democrat Party, to me, was always supposed to be the kind of gentler for the people party as opposed to the rich, uncaring, capitalist pigs on the Republican side. But what has really got to me, I think, and since Donald Trump has come onto the political scene, is that a conservative voice is instantly racist and everything, every other name under the sun. And when you look at college campuses and the reaction that conservative speakers have, they're heckled, riots, they come in, they shut them down. It appears to me that Democrat side to things, the progressive side, the need to shut down the conservative voice has become laughable. Right. And I'm not sure what they're so afraid of.
Well, I think somehow, I don't think free speech has any purchase on people under a certain age. You'll find liberals of 60, 70, whatever, who'll say, they do the apocryphal Voltaire quote, I disagree with what you say, but I'll fight to the death. But then when you go in the other direction, you go in 40, 30, and you reach college students, free speech is not a core value to them. They have been taught that it takes a backseat to identity politics. So that on a range of issues, there's a correct position on gay marriage, and other stuff is not just a different point of view, it's wrong. There's a correct position on transgender rights, and other stuff is not just a disagreement. It's wrong. There's a correct position on climate change. There's a correct position on Islam. There's a correct position on immigration. Well, if you keep adding to those list of subjects on which there's one permitted point of view, there's actually not a lot left to have any kind of open debate about. And it's actually, that's one reason why their skills are atrophying on that. It's also one reason. I think, you know, we were talking about comedy earlier. I think comedy is actually one of the victims of that. That, you know, comedy depends on a certain element of recognition. And things that you recognize, you can no longer say on the left. Which is why so many, you know, Jerry Seinfeld and other comedians just have stopped playing university campuses because there's nothing you can actually the list of things that you can make approved jokes about has got shorter and shorter and shorter.
Do you see, is there any similarity to this in Canada? Is there that polarization in Canada, or is it just purely an American phenomenon?
No, I think it's true. I think it's true in when I ran into some legal difficulties with Canada's human rights commissions about a decade ago, and Jonah Goldberg at National Review wrote that he goes, Canada is like one American, is like one big American university campus. Either that or every American university campus is like a little Canada. Yeah. And you see it to the same, you see it, the phenomenon in Australia, you see it in Europe.
Yep.
I'm always astonished at the way we surrender free speech so easily. The way even successful and powerful people are scared and actually back down. And it amazes – when Carrie Fisher died a couple of years back, Carrie and Debbie Reynolds, her mother, died within a few days of each other. It's a very sad thing. And Paul Simon, who'd been married to Carrie Fisher, and I remember this because I'd spent a few days with Paul Simon at his house out on Montauk, and I remember we were just like sitting on the terrace one night, and we were talking about Debbie Reynolds because he was like who was his mother-in-law,
right.
And he was like amazed at her business acumen because she was like cleaning up in Vegas. She bought all the stuff that MGM wanted to throw out, and she was sitting on a fortune and everything. And he was just like, so he was like talking as one rock star to to this happy, you know, chirpy tap dancer, like amazed at the business act. And so when Carrie Fisher died, he did a heartfelt tweet. Steve Martin did a heartfelt tweet.
Yes.
And they both referred to how, you know, she was beautiful and I think Steve Martin said, "Oh, the most beautiful girl when I met her, the most beautiful." And immediately all these Twitter people fall on them and say, "You can't say that. You're diminishing a person because you're just obsessing on her looks." Who the hell are you? You're
ridiculous.
Tweeting at a guy who was married to the woman. He knows her. You don't. Why? How dare you in the moment, in the instant of his grief, impose your stupid rules on how he wants to express his grief for his former wife? And that's what is fascinating to me about identity politics is that it actually winds up dehumanizing you, so that you can know so that. You become actually angry about people relating to each other at a human level because all you can do is put them into your identity politics boxes.
You know, I do have to say, though, with the college campuses, that I think schools like UC Berkeley and NYU give the rest of the American schools a bad rep, because I just graduated the University of South Carolina almost a year ago. And I could tell you firsthand that down there in the Southeast, University of Georgia, University of Florida, these problems that they're having, that Berkeley's having, it's not going on down there. And the conservative voice and the liberal voice is cherished. Maybe not by everyone, but we don't have people protesting like that.
They allow both to be heard.
Exactly. Yeah. But I will say this. And I wonder if this is happening at schools like Berkeley and other ones. When I was there, there were some liberals that worked in the offices in the housing department as the RAs. And they pushed the liberal agenda onto freshmen coming in. Oh, let's talk about this. Let's talk about that. Liberal issues. So I do wonder, you know, how much of it is a school-wide issue, a campus-wide issue, rather than just the people who are – you know, pushing it down a lot of freshmen and other impressionable students on campus.
No, I think that's true. I mean, I think generally there's been an overexpansion of higher education, but within that, an overexpansion of an administrative bureaucracy, which is in large part an exercise in social engineering. You have people with absolutely I was talking to Lindsay Shepherd, a young lady who at Wilfrid Laurier University in Canada, and that name will mean nothing to you, but Ash is leaping to say Sir Wilfrid was the first Francophone Prime Minister of Canada. Weren't you?
Yes.
He was writing it down.
Took the words right out of my mouth.
And she was like hauled over the coals. But it was interesting to me when I talked to her, the titles that these people had, you know, who was, they had had, you know, the deputy assistant dean of gendered violence and identity issues and things like that. I mean, there is an absurd level of bureaucracy now at these places that is attempting to enforce these things. And I don't say it's every university. And in fact, I think a lot of the times it actually starts, you know, there was the famous thing at the Oxford Union in the early 30s, the famous motion, this house would not vote for king and country. And people thought, well, they're just privileged elites at the most prestigious university. Mm-hmm. But a lot of what's changed is that a lot of those ideas now have come down from the most decadent and elite institutions to the fact that they're actually routine in grade school and kindergarten.
Yeah. Mm.
So a lot of the time, you know, by the time you're 18 or 19, you've already had a decade or more of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
What could Canadians teach Americans? Are they as polite as we're told they are, Canadians? Are they that polite?
I don't think, if I had to say, and I say this as someone who loves Quebec, I would say if you wanted to meet perhaps the rudest people on the North American continent, it would be Quebecers. And God bless, as I said, God bless them. I love that. You know, against that, you know, they are also, I believe, they have the most beautiful women folk on the North American continent, so it's all about trade-offs. You know, you'll have a real striking piece of eye candy, but she'll make your life hell. So there are always...
Be careful. The Twitter might start
I'm way beyond that. And I love the way, you know, when you're... what I always get frustrated about is if I've been north of the border, like I'm driving around in Quebec, and then I drive across the border into Vermont, and suddenly you're sitting behind somebody who's like doing 28 miles an hour, you know, for the whole and of course, because you're like in this psyched up Quebec mode of driving, and I love the way one of my newspapers in New Hampshire rated all, because Massachusetts drivers have a low reputation in New Hampshire, and it was like grading all of them, you know. New Hampshire drivers like that, Vermont drivers like that, Massachusetts drivers are pushy, obnoxious to speed. Wow. Quebec drivers just pull over to the shoulder and wait
till they go.
It's like, so I think Canadians' niceness is overrated, and I resent that. And the interesting because I that. You know, if you had, for example, if you'd been touring the North American continent in, say, 1938 or 39, and you'd just gone on trains around the U.S. and Canada, you would have thought Canada was the martial nation. You would have seen a lot more men in uniform going about Canada. Canada, in 1945, the Royal Canadian Navy was the third largest surface fleet in the world. Ash will know this, but the on D-Day, there were five beaches. The Americans got two, and the British Empire got three, of which two were UK and one were Canadian. Mm-hmm. And almost all military historians agree that the Canadians got the toughest
assignment,
beach. And so I don't like this, oh, we're the nice people. No, we weren't nice on D-Day, and we weren't, you know, and there's a whole
but
other...
But nice doesn't mean to say weak.
No, but there is a whole... this idea that we're just all Trudeaupian pansies, that, you know, Justin Trudeau, the 12-year-old boy trapped in a 12-year-old girl's body, who toured India. I mean, he and Hillary did successive tours of India.
That's right.
And they swapped wardrobes.
he was not storming D-Day.
So Justin Trudeau tours India looking like a bride, dressed as a bridesmaid in a Bollywood movie, and like the Indian press can't make out what the hell. And then Hillary lands, and she's wearing all her Nehru jackets, and they're thinking, what the hell are they doing? This went out when Prime Minister Nehru retired, you know. And so I have no idea. I don't like the idea of, oh, why can't we all? That's basically a liberal chimera, you know, this whole thing. Oh, well, you know, when Trump's elected, we're all going to. Canada is basically the liberals' rapture, you know, that when
well, half of the American celebrities should be living in Canada right now because they're all vowed to move there, didn't they?
They're all there every week anyway because every American movie is filmed in Vancouver and Montreal. So it's not as if it's not like you know saying, oh, I'm moving to Chad. The property prices are very reasonable. They already know the market, you know.
Didn't they always say about Canada that Canada could have had British culture.
Right.
They could have had American technology and French cuisine.
Right.
Instead, they ended up with American culture, British cuisine, and French technology.
But it is just it's like desperately. I mean that whole thing of you know Alec Baldwin Lena Dunham. Oh, if Trump wins, we're going to move to Canada. I mean, it's so insulting to say you know when the powder keg goes up here, then we'll go to Canada.
And they assume, of course, that Canada will take them.
Yes, I would actually be surprised if all these American celebrities were able to get past.
Yes.
And that's actually why Canadians need the wall. after Trump's second term, you're going to need something to keep Lena Dunham out.
So that wall is to keep American celebrities out. Got it.
Now, I want to take this to Europe. Now, you have famously talked about Eurabia.
Right.
This concept of the Islamic religion.
Right.
Being the dominant religion of Europe someday. And I want to ask you, how do you still feel about that statement, especially with this migrant crisis that the continent's having right now?
Well, people don't understand demographics, which is a simple thing. There's two things about demographics. People think you're making predictions.
Mm-hmm.
And it isn't really, because if you only have, say, you know, a million babies born this year, it's hard to have 2 million people entering the workforce in 20 years' time. So that's not a prediction. You can go to the maternity wards and see what your future is going to look like. And if you go, my mother was Belgian, for example, it would astonish her to learn that in Antwerp, a city she knew very well, a majority of children in the grade schools are Muslim now. They're no longer Catholic. And things like that have happened in an extraordinarily swift extraordinary speed.
Mm-hmm.
Sweden, which is not anybody's idea of a big nation of immigrants, ethnic Swedes are going to be a minority in their own country by 2050. And again, people don't really think of the future, because when you say 2050, it sounds like a long way away. But it's basically from 1990 to now.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So forget the Roseanne reboot. Think about when you watched Roseanne first time round. It's actually, you know, 2050 will be here sooner than
you
think.
Before you know it. Yeah.
And Sweden will be utterly transformed. And I like Sweden. I like ABBA. I
love Björn Borg. He was great.
Björn from ABBA, which was much Björn from Björn Borg was just like an ace machine.
Yes. Yes.
I was in Sweden a couple of years ago, and I went to, I can't remember now whether it's Benny or Bjorn from ABBA, one of them, had gotten mixed up with some little Swedish folk music group centered around this little town in central Sweden. And I happened to pass through that town in the middle of the woods in central Sweden. Thought I'd look up, you know, this little bit of Swedish folk music that Benny or Bjorn, as the case may be, had been from ABBA had been so excited by. And I've driven for 100 kilometers through the Swedish woods, And I come to this little town in the middle of nowhere, and the first thing I see is the little supermarket on the edge of town and this group of covered women coming out of it. And I laughed, and I thought to myself, that's like amazing, from ABBA to Abahu Akbar
in a short amount of time.
And it's like a cute joke, but it isn't really. It's happening, and it's sad. And I'm not even, by the way, I'm not a multiculturalist, because one of the things I like about, I used to like about travel is, as I said, my mother was Belgian, mm-hmm. and you could go like 50 miles in any direction. You'd be in another country where the language was different, different architectural styles, different food. And it was interesting to me, and I find multicultural. It's not even a racial thing. I just feel it's making everything boring. It's making every big city the same.
Well, you're losing your identity, and the aging of Europe is a massive problem. Yeah. Native born people are getting older and dying off, and being replaced by a much greater Muslim population. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of time before that population overcomes the native population. It's just a numbers game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's very hard to buck the numbers game, and it has huge implications for things. People, I find, for example, in London, it's very interesting. I was walking down the Commercial Road in the East End of London.
Yep.
And many years ago, I'd briefly dated a nurse at the Royal London Hospital in Whitechapel, and we used to go to...
That's very East End.
Yeah, very East End. And we used to go, like, round the corner to a pub called the Blind Beggar, which was famous because one of the Cray brothers, who were a notorious London gang, had walked in and shot a guy, and the bullet had passed through him, hit the jukebox, and the jukebox had started playing "The Sun Ain't Gonna Shine Anymore," which was, for this guy, was true. Wow. So we used to, so it was like all East End, go down the old Kent Road, your father, all that.
Pop your uncle,
And I walked down, I was walking through the East End, and I suddenly noticed that things like famous gay pubs had gone. And then I noticed, which you think that's fair enough because, it's Islamized. That's understandable. And then I noticed that all the chip shops had gone too. And so it's actually hard to get fish and chips
in
London's East End. And these things happen far faster than people think they do.
Well, for 5 years running, the most popular boy's name in London is Muhammad.
Well,
I even make jokes about New York because I used to say, this to your point that, culture disappears quickly. Mm-hmm. I used to make a joke, I don't have to travel outside of New York because if I want to go to China, I'll go to Chinatown. If I want to go to, if I want to go to Italy, I go to Italy. If I want to go to Russia, I go to Brighton Beach.
Right.
Now... Yeah. It's all the same, New York, really. Yeah,
and I think that's actually one of the. I don't really like. I find that sad because nothing is quite. And that's true even in an. I would say even in an intra-Muslim sense. I mean, one place I find very interesting is Rosengard, which is the just outside downtown Malmo in Sweden. And when you go there, it's 100% Muslim. But what's interesting to me is that. Even Muslim women who came to Sweden from like the Balkans or the Central Asian stans and who had never had to be covered when they were in the Balkans or those stans, when they move to Sweden and they live in Rosengard, they have to be covered. So you're getting – it's not even as if you're getting an authentic Bosnian or Tajik woman living in your neighborhood. She's become she has been submerged within some identity that's neither Swedish nor Bosnian, and she's like in something that's some strange East meets West thing that is unique to that ghetto, and it's very bizarre that.
Yeah.
We've talked a lot about Brexit, Mark, and we'll wrap this up soon, I promise, because we could talk all afternoon, all night. You're trapped in here, buddy. you know, I was in Britain covering Brexit, and I know you did a lot on it as well. And the sentiment there wasn't particularly anti. It wasn't, you know, fear of foreigners by any means. It was just people fed up with the directions that were coming out of Brussels, and both from a law point of view and just from regulations. How do you see the future of Europe? A lot has been said about the Eurozone, that it's teetering, that, you know, you have this, you know, you have the German-French alliance right now, but certainly the southern countries, the Italys, the Greeces. Greece is always broke, let's be honest, but the Italys are very, you know, they do not like what's been happening, and there is a threat that they could ultimately drop out, which would bring the whole thing falling down.
Yeah, I think we're past the limits of European integration, and there will be a kind of not necessarily total disintegration, but I think there will be a separating out, and there will be a de facto multi-speed Europe for very basic reasons. You know, I think when Angela Merkel understands that whatever the European Union may pretend, that Greeks are not Germans, and there's a difference, and that it is, as it almost always is everywhere, it's the human capital that determines the kind of society you live in. And that is a reality that... I mean, what's funny to me about when we were talking about the refugee thing earlier is that Angela Merkel understands that you can't turn Greeks into Germans, but she thinks you can take millions and millions of Sudanese and Yemeni, and they can be Germans in 20 minutes. In a sense, but she's right on the first thing. You can't turn Greeks into Germans. And I think the other interesting lesson is the pushback from Eastern Europe on some of these migration issues, that they don't want to go the way Western Europe has gone. I find Brexit... I was there on the morning of Brexit, and I'd gone to bed seeing a very disappointed-looking Nigel Farage assumed that assumed that the thing was lost. And I like woke up. I had to catch a flight to Dublin, the little shuttle from Heathrow to Dublin. And I wake up and I sort of switch the TV on, and there's an ashen-faced
David Cameron,
David Dimbleby on the BBC, announcing that the. And I go to Heathrow Airport, and the announcer on the tannoy is doing all this stuff. Please be advised that despite the Brexit vote, flights will still be permitted to depart at the schedule. So it's all like last train from Berlin. It's like, and we all get on this like little puddle jumper to Dublin with Aer Lingus, and they're like popping the champagne. They're popping the champagne corks. And we're all laughing about these like wacky announcements that the world has ended at Heathrow Airport. And it's kind of pathetic because to go back to my Vice Regal gags about the Marquess of Dufferin, you know, when people say, well, you know, the United Kingdom hasn't handled its own trade policy since 1973. It's absurd to think we can just start trading with nations all over. You know, this is a country.
What?
This is a country that has written the constitutions of over 50 sovereign states, starting with my own 1867. And if you look at the 1867 British North America Act, and then if you look at a decolonized, you know, in the 80s, Belize or the Solomon Islands, it's basically the 1867 template all over again. Everyone, and so the United Kingdom's position is that the Solomon Islanders can handle sovereignty, but the mother country is,
doesn't know what to do.
No, and I remember after the Iraqi constitution, I got this fantastic email from a retired Welsh colonial office civil servant that began, having written the constitutions of three countries myself, which I thought was like the coolest line ever. And suddenly the only colony in the entire British Empire that cannot move to self-government is the United Kingdom.
Motherland.
It's like, I mean, that has been a pathetic thing to have
it
to
really
listen
has.
To.
Yeah. But they'll get it sorted out. They're going to have to. I mean, it's, you know, next year they'll be gone. So
yeah, no,
they better warn quick.
No. I will be glad to.
And you're going to be covering it with a lot of humor.
Yeah, well, it will be a great moment, and I like Nigel Farage. I mean, Nigel Farage is a very good example. He'll never be Prime Minister, he'll never be Foreign Secretary, he'll never be Chancellor of the Exchequer or anything like that, and yet he has been more consequential any of the people who held those positions and are already entirely forgotten.
It's nothing better than watching Nigel Farage stand up and give a speech at the European Parliament, you know, in Strasbourg and just rail them for half an hour where they all just stare at him in, you know, mortifying looks, and he is having the time of his life.
Yeah, no, I know, and he's a very good example of how if you're secure and you're rooted in what you think.
What you believe.
And again, he's another one. He broke all the rules, that smoking. I actually did a thing. I spoke with Nigel. We were debate partners in Toronto a couple of years back. And Nigel is a serious guy to debate with because he'd been furious. He'd arrived about an hour before me, and he'd been furious that there was no drink in the dressing room. So they'd had, you know, because they're these abstemious Torontonians, and
where's my booze?
So they'd gone and got all these like bottles of red wine for him. And I thought, oh, I don't really like drinking before I go. I'm not very good sober, and I'm not that great. So I say to my assistant, I say, oh, could you just get me, you know, a glass of Sauvignon Blanc? And he says, he goes, what the, is that you drink? It looks a bit like a Nancy boy drink. So I had to butch up for going on stage, and he has a fantastic view of regular. I mean, he wanted to smoke, so they tell him that you can't smoke within 9 meters of a building in Toronto, and he goes nine meters. That must have been a ruthlessly negotiated compromise. You know, it's like, we wanted to make it 10, but they weren't ready to go there yet. Give us a couple of years, and I think. I would just like politicians to be normal, and in that sense, as outrageous as they appear, both Nigel and Donald Trump, they're doing representative government a huge service by just saying you can stagger around saying all the wrong things, doing all the wrong things, and none of it matters, because the people who tell us, this disqualifies you and that disqualifies you, are the people who want to keep politics as a tight little club for a professional political class, and that's a disaster.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to have to leave it right there. Mark Stein, thank you so much for coming in today. You're always a mine of information, but you also do it with a lot of tremendous wit and insight. And even for a Canadian, he's a good guy, huh?
Not
what
too
you say?
Not too bad. A little rude, but...
I went to a comedy club in Calgary, as you do.
Right.
And I remember the comedian there saying, you know, Americans always make fun of us because we say A at the end of everything. Mm. He said, we want to actually call him something else, but we just use the first letter. And we'll leave it right there.
I can neither confirm nor deny.
And that does it for the Ashley Webster Experience. Ashley Webster alongside Brian Solomon. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back here next time.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Kilmeade. I want you to join me weekdays at 9 a.m. East as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and, of course, what you think.
Listen live or get the podcast now at BrianKilmeadeShow.com.